Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Asia and the literary journal AGNI. Our speaker is Indian journalist, publisher, and author Taran Tejpal. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Assistant Professor of International Relations Manjari Chatterjee Miller.
Taran, thank you very much for coming. We are very, very excited to have you here today. And, you know, when I was asked to do this introduction for Mr. Tejpal, I thought I would do this very brief introduction, and then I realized that his resume was so impressive that I actually had to take notes. So, without much ado, let me give you Mr. Tejpal, who actually grew up in a military family in India. Your father was an army officer. He studied at Punjab University in Chandigarh, economics, I believe. And then he started off in the 1980s as a journalist with India Today. And India Today in the 1980s was a premier news magazine in India, you know, similar to, say, Newsweek and Time. It held the same position. And in the 80s, for whatever reason, which hopefully we'll discover during the talk, he left India Today and went on to become one of the founders of Outlook magazine, which rivaled India Today and actually gave India Today quite a good run for its money. But then in 2000, he did something very, very incredible. He started a news website called Tehelka.com. And for those of you who are not familiar with it, Tehelka is spelled T-E-H-E-L-K-A, Tehelka.com. And Tehelka.com was the first news agency of its kind in India because what it specialized in was sting operations, exposés. And it started off in 2000 by exposing match fixing in cricket. But then it became really famous because it conducted something called Operation West End, which exposed corruption at the highest levels of the defense ministry in India, actually leading to the resignation of then defense minister George Fernandes. Okay. And that put Tehelka on the map, both domestically and internationally. And since then, Tehelka is known for these exposés. In 2007, for example, Tehelka went and interviewed undercover, many of the people who are responsible for the Gujarat riots, where Muslims were killed in masses in Gujarat in 2002, and got them to confess on camera. And recently, actually, in spring of 2012, if any of you follow Nick Kristof on Facebook, he posted a link to Tehelka's expose on police constables and police officers in India and their views on rape, which were highly misogynistic and utterly depressing, to say the least. But the reason I bring this up is because as I was reading Mr. Tejpal's second book, The Story of My Assassins, which he's here today to talk about, it struck me that it was extremely parallel. It had very strong parallels with his journalistic career. So I'm very curious to find out how autobiographical it is and, you know, where he got his inspiration from. So without much ado, Mr. Tejpal.
Well, you know, I mean, all writers write from their own lived experiences, but it doesn't mean the books that they write, certainly not the novels that they write, are really their stories. So The Story of My Assassins is not my story. It's the story of the narrator who tells the story. I'm just the writer. In fact, the challenge of writing The Story of My Assassins really was finding the voice for it. The conceit for the book, the idea for the book had actually come to me in 2001. One morning, it was a Sunday, I remember. There are a few seed incidents in the book that are true, absolutely true to life, and it actually opens with one of those incidents in the book. Maybe I'll just read you the first two paragraphs so you can quickly understand what I'm trying to say. The morning I heard I'd been shot, I was sitting in my office on the second floor, looking out the big glass window at the yellow ringlets of a laburnum tree that had gone in a few days from blindingly golden to faded cream as if washed in rough detergent. Beyond the balding tree, losing its ringlets prematurely in mid-May, the sky was blamelessly blue. In minutes, it would begin to bleach, and the sun would paint such a glare on it, it would be impossible to look up, even briefly, to catch the full bellies of groaning aircraft swooping down to land. It was not yet 7 in the morning. I had slipped away early from my darkened bedroom with barely a glance at the sleeping splash of my wife, lying spread-eagled on her stomach, arms and legs akimbo, as if quashed by a giant foot. Brushing my teeth in the dining room sink, I had glanced at the weekend newspapers, full of the excitements of food and cinema, and eschewing the tea, Felicia had said to Brew, quietly let myself out. So it was Sunday morning, I remember. This is one of the few sort of seed incidents that maybe is roughly true. I was sitting in my office. There was nobody around. I was just trying to send off some emails, and my phone rang. It was probably 10 in the morning. I picked up the phone, and there was a friend of mine from Bombay on the line. He said, "You're alive." It was with a big question mark at the end of it. And I said, "What are you talking about?" So he said, "Turn on the television set." And I turned on the television set, and the breaking news on all the news channels was that a murder bid on Tarun Tejpal had been foiled. Within the next 1 hour, I received sort of scores of calls from all across the country because for some reason the Delhi police had issued a press release that said murder attempt on Tarun Tejpal foiled without letting on that the attempt had never taken place. What had really happened was the Delhi police had picked up 5 hitmen who had, it seems, taken a contract to take a hit on me. And the story that was told to us was curiously bizarre. The story that they told us ran something like this. They said that the ISI of Pakistan had given 5 hitmen from India a contract in Kathmandu, Nepal, to kill me in Delhi. So this was the story that we were told. And the rationale behind it was that if something happened to me, the government of the day would collapse. And the reason was that a few months earlier, on March 13, 2001, we had broken a story which Manjari just referred to. It's called Operation West End, which basically blew the lid on corruption in defense procurements. It had led to the resignation of the Defense Minister of India. It had led to the resignation of the president of the ruling party. It had led to the capturing of several generals of the Indian Army. And what had also happened then was that the government had hit back at us very viciously. So we were locked at that particular point, a battle that was to last many years, and we were to be shut down for several years, in fact, with lots of false cases put against us. At that particular time, we were locked in this kind of crazy battle with the government of the day, which was the right-wing BJP government, the NDA government. And so there was some kind of perverse rationale at work which suggested that anything that happened to me, because it was a very public battle, you know, it was happening on the national networks every day. Just before this news of the hit had come, my bell had rung in one morning at home, and I'd opened the door, and there was this cop, this policeman standing outside, and he said he had come to guard me. When I asked him what he was doing there, he said, I've come to guard you. So I said, okay. I gave him a chair outside my door, and he sat down there, and he had this 9mm revolver tucked into his belt, and he would sit there all day, and every time I stepped out of the house, he would follow me around. And 4 or 5 days later, the bell rang again, and there was a sub-inspector standing outside. So I asked him what he wanted, and he said, "We've decided you need more guards." So another 6 guards arrived. Within 10 or 15 days, I had about 24 armed policemen guarding me 24 hours a day. My house was sandbagged, my office was sandbagged, and all this then got mingled into this story of the hitmen and so on and so forth. It's around that time, or a few weeks later, that this whole idea... There's a very strong literary side of me. There's a journalistic side of me, and then there's the literary side of me. The literary side of me kicked in, and I began to wonder about the material that was kind of coming my way in terms of a literary examination, a literary exploration. And I remember soon after the title for the book came to me, The Story of My Assassins, because I was being told constantly about these 5 guys they had picked up without being told anything. You know, it's a classic Indian way. Everything is a miasma. Everything is opaque. You're told everything and you're still told nothing. So I knew nothing. So really, that was the starting point of thinking about the book. But it took me many years. It took me almost 4 years for the material to gestate in my head for me to arrive at a voice that would allow me to tell the story. I had a great problem finding that tone. And it's only when I found the tone of that highly dyspeptic, acidic, dislikable narrator, you know, the narrator is a really dislikable character. Mm-hmm. It's only when I found that particular voice, that highly dyspeptic voice, that I was able to start writing. And immediately the material opened up the moment I found that voice. So really, it's not at all, the story is really outside of me. It has very little to do with my life. It has to do a lot with the things in life that interest me or concern me.
So there's 2 angles to this, right? I mean, you just pointed this out. There's your literary side and your journalistic side. And the starting point is obviously the book. But then as the story unfolds, I grew up in India and, you know, I'm very familiar with journalism there. I keep seeing, you know, the Helka operation. So, you know, there's a description, for example, I marked it because I thought it was so interesting, where you say, well, a bunch of guys running a website had cracked wide open the rules of the journalistic game. Using spy cameras, they had hauled in footage of the rich, the powerful, and the animals who worked the in-between, grabbing crisp rupee notes from reporters posing as arms dealers. And that's very much true, right, when you started Telka in 2000?
That's just a minor riff. So that itself should make it clear to you that the book is not about me or about what happened with us, mm-hmm. because that particular riff is about what happened to us. It's only last three paragraphs, but that what you were just reading is a short sort of riff in the middle of the book, which is really about what happened to us. So what you were mentioning right now was what really happened to us.
So it's like snippets that are woven through
But that's with all, I think anybody who writes a novel or writes literary fiction does that. At the end of the day, the material for everything you write comes from your life. It's things you've seen, eaten, drunk, experienced, felt, made love to. I mean, they all come from your own life. I mean, the material has to come from somewhere. Let me give you a simple analogy. It's like ingredients in a kitchen. You know, you have 100 ingredients in a kitchen, or maybe you have 50 ingredients in a kitchen, but you can make 100 dishes out of that. Mm-hmm. So it's not the ingredient, it's the dish you prepare, and every dish is an original dish. So, I mean, the material comes from somewhere, but as I said, every story is totally its own story. And this is certainly, the story that I write here is not my story. It's right. The story of the people in the book.
Well, you know, what I really liked about it is there was this very multifaceted look at the complexity that is India, right? So it's not black and white, and it's all shades of gray. And so, I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, I think I was just telling you this, some of your descriptions just made me laugh out loud because they just hit so true to stereotypes in India. I marked one. I mean, this is a true academic thing. You can see their post-its here. Anyway, but, and I think it was right in the beginning when you talked about, the narrator's talking about his father, and he says, the central concern, and he focused simply on the central concern of his life, his unending struggle with paper. And this is so emblematic of Indian life, you know, the reading of newspapers, the filing of bank statements, tax returns, insurance papers, postal deposit, telephone bills, water bills, cable TV bills. You know, when I go to the archives, you know, the papers that I find, the forms that I file in triplicate. When I went and got a cell phone store to get a local SIM, I had to file everything in quadruplicate. So this is, you know, but things like that just really hit true to life. But despite, you know, the laughter, by the time I get to the end, it's really not a message of hope, right? It's a very depressing ending, and I think you're aware of this. So to what extent, it almost seems like there's very little optimism in the book about the future of India and the social problems that it's dealing with, particularly corruption. I mean, would you say that's a fair conclusion from the book?
First of all, the job of people who struggle to write literature is not to provide optimism, you know. That's the job of priests and professors, yeah. It's not the job of, you know, I mean, you don't read Kafka get rendered optimistic, you know. At the end of the day, I think the challenge of writing literature is to, one, cut as close to the bone as possible, and secondly, I think to be subversive. I think both the vocations I pursue, journalism and literary fiction, are both fundamentally subversive vocations. Their job is really to subvert status quo, subvert ways of seeing. And when I say subvert, I mean it in a very large sense. I don't mean it in some kind of a small, petty sense. It's really about questioning things, yeah? I'm not too concerned whether people reading the story of my assassins laugh or are rendered pessimistic or optimistic. I'm really concerned whether it alters ways of seeing. And one of the reasons for writing the story of my assassins was really because I was a little exhausted by the sort of what I think are highly sanitized narratives out of India that had begun to get traction around the world for the last 20 years. There's a kind of novel out of India that has gained traction around the world, you know. And I find that novel is so untrue to the reality of India. I mean, the reality of India is unbelievably complex. It's easily the most complex country in the world. And you were getting a kind of narrative out of here which seemed, and I understood why the narrative worked, because it seemed to suit, you know, Western publishers, Western agents, Western readers, but it wasn't true. And it bothered me a great deal as someone who's lived and worked in India all my life.
That almost sounds like you're putting a journalistic hat on rather than the
literary. No, I'm not. I'm actually putting a literary hat on. I'm talking about the writing, the literature. I'm not talking about the journalism. The journalism is separate. I'm talking about the literary novels out of India that have been doing the rounds around the world for the last 20 years. I will not take names, but it's the kind of writing that just did not ring true. It just rang of a kind of a very commercial eye on a sort of audience around the world. And I understand that too, because when you write in English in India, your true readership is actually global. If you write in English in India as a novelist, you can't survive unless you have a global audience, because there aren't enough readers in India to help you survive. So it was leading to a sort of skew in the sort of literary fare that was coming out of India. And there was the truth of India is that there are a million stories waiting to be told. There is a multiplicity of stories, and there's an incredible polyphony. The challenge of writing the story of my assassins was to somehow capture that polyphony. Anybody who lives in India knows that this nation speaks in a million registers. The nation also speaks in thousands of languages, you know, apart from a million registers. It has conflicts that range. I mean, the fault lines are numberless. The fault lines are caste, religion, class, language. I mean, there are so many fault lines dividing us on large fault lines. Then there are the smaller fault lines. I mean, it's an incredibly complex country trying to work its narrative out. To imagine that its literature, at least in English, I'm sure it's not true in other languages, but in English, to find no echo of this complexity. I mean, it was really... I found that from the 80s, when I got into the 90s, I stopped reading all Indians who write fiction in English because they had nothing to say to me. So in a sense, the story of my assassins is a counter-narrative of India. It's really a narrative of the underclass in many ways. It's a narrative about the stories of India that are never told, you know. And that was the challenge of writing it. And that's why when the conceit first came to me, the story of my assassins, I was very excited because I thought, because for a writer, I mean, the challenges are not just content. Very often they're also structurally, how do you enter material? For me, the idea that I could suddenly enter a whole zone of material that is very difficult to enter through the lives of these assassins, that excited me. And now that you've read the book, you know that actually I open up the other stories of India actually by getting in the stories of the assassins. So there are two different narratives playing themselves out. One is a narrative of the kind of elite, anglicized narrator. And then there are the narratives of the people whose mm-hmm. lives are actually so removed, from his life in a real sense, right. Which are opened up through his mistress in a way, you know, because in a do-gooding mm-hmm. zeal. But the idea was really to get these multiple stories out, and also get the multiple registers, you know, the registers of sorrow, happiness, philosophy, idiocy, and a big thing, the spirituality inherent in India in all its glory and ugliness. You know, I mean, there is that. So, I mean, I was trying to play with as many of the complex themes in India. And I'm saying that, for me, is the true arena of a novelist. I mean, that's what a novelist can do that a historian can't do and a journalist can't do. That's what, because, you know, you can enter. So, in the story of my assassins, you can essay history, you can essay religion, you can essay emotion, you can essay journalism. You can actually do it all. So for me, that was the... And as I've been saying for years, that the material in India today for a writer is extraordinary. Where is this great writing? It's not coming. And the truth of all great writing is that all great writing in any society occurs at a time when a society is trying to articulate itself for itself. I mean, the great French writing happens in the mid and late 19th century when France is trying to find its own soul. The great American writing happens at the turn of the century and the beginning of the 20th century when America is trying to find its soul. It's the same true of Russian. Look at the great Russian literature. It comes at a time when Russia is trying to find its own soul. Where is this great writing in India? This is a huge subcontinent of 1,200,000,000 people trying to articulate itself, should be trying to articulate itself. Where is the writing that tells us who we are? Where is the writing that makes us look in the mirror?
Yeah, gritty was definitely the word that came to mind. So this is not meant to be a conversation just between me and Tarun. So, you know, I will open it up and, you know, I can moderate and take questions. I have a lot, but yeah.
So the character of Sarah, and I wondered if she was a character to you first or the device that enabled this apathetic narrator to become more interested in all of these stories. I mean, which part of her came to you first?
Well, you know, I mean, in writing a book, it's always a very complex mix of ideas, personalities, quirks, you know, themes that you want to get into. And novels emerge hugely organically, I mean, which is why I always wonder at the writer's subliminal processes, because even the story of my assassins, it has a neat architecture if you look at the book carefully. But it wasn't architected in advance. It's how it emerged. You know, which means there is a kind of subliminal ordering of material that goes on all the time, and you're not even aware of it. So Sarah emerged from the narrative. When I began to write, she wasn't there. And then she was there on the page one day, suddenly, you know, on the 8th or 10th or 11th day of writing, she emerged, you know, right, as the narrator's mistress. And then she acquired a life of her own and then became a central candidate in the book itself. So you actually start many times with just a title or a broad idea of the material you want to engage with. What are the kind of animals or tools that will help you see that material through you're not fully aware of, you know? So actually all characters emerge as you write. You know, for example, if I look at the five assassins, I had absolutely no sense of them when I began to write the book, well, who these people would be. You know, and they kept emerging one by one as I kept writing the book. All of them. You're talking about Hathoda Tyagi. You know, all of them. They all emerged as... In fact, he's the last assassin to appear in the book. They all emerged one by one as I kept writing and as the book kept taking shape. They were obviously part of my own consciousness somewhere without, you know... So what I'm saying is it wasn't put down on a paper and architected that this is how this book is going to be and this is what it's going to be, five books, three chapters each, one narrator, or one... Even the device of the interlinked chapters, the narrator's chapters and the ones of the three chapters each that the assassins get, you know, the books in the middle... All of that emerged as the writing took place. You know, what was a struggle was the voice. I struggled with that for 4 years. The moment I had the voice, the material opened itself up completely. You know.
While the gentleman is making his way, I have a quick question, which is that, you know, you just talked about this. You said that there's not this self-reflection in India. Where's the thinking about where we're going, where we should be going, what we are, who we are, right? So it almost implies that there should be a transitive crisis. Like, what transitive crisis do you think India is going through now that should be prompting these self-reflections?
No, first of all, I'm not saying there are no self-reflections. I'm saying the absence of a literature that echoes it. That's what I was talking about. I mean, what journalism does, what history does, what social sciences do is one thing. There is also something that literature does with more blood and bone in it than others. I think that's been missing for me. I don't see that happening. Of course, there's a lot of self-reflection going on. The best Indians alive today are thinking damn hard about their country, and that's exactly what they should be doing. I think all of us spend most of our waking hours trying to understand what is the story of this country? What is its current narrative? And where is it headed? And there are no easy... We will discuss that in detail as we go along, but that's the kind of story that I think what we're going through today is an extremely difficult phase in our lives. It's a kind of midlife crisis. We've had a great youth crisis. Now we're having a midlife crisis, so it goes on. What we are seeing probably is in Naipaul's famous phrase, a million mutinies now. And there are, if you look in the Northeast, there's ethnic conflict. If you look in Kashmir, there's religious conflict. If you look at the heart of India, almost one-third of India's districts today have a degree of class conflict with the Maoists and the Naxalites, being highly active. Apart from that, you have the whole Dalit upsurgence going on. You have tribal issues. You have a country that's in great, great ferment. And I think the thing to understand here is, which I think even back home we miss most of the time, is that 62 years later, a country that, in my opinion, the idea of India, which is, in my opinion, the greatest creative experiment of the last probably 200 years, in a mass experiment in the last 200 years, is, I think, today beginning to bear fruit. You know, when the founding fathers, who were all extraordinary men, in my opinion, the greatest bunch of great men who ever lived at any single time, when the founding fathers came together to form the idea of India, I think what they were looking at was a country which was almost 90% illiterate. It had no GDP, less than 1%. It had a population of 350 million already. It was abjectly poor. It was coming out of 200 years of colonialism. It was coming out of 1,000 years of feudalism. It was a country that was really in trouble in many ways. Despite that, the founding fathers chose overnight to transform it into a modern liberal democracy. I mean, that's an extraordinary act, that they took a country like that in 1947 and 1950 and decided to transform it into modernity straight away, a modern liberal democracy. They did many, many significant things, out of which two are really important to always remember. The first they did was, what they did was universal adult suffrage. It had never happened anywhere. They gave everybody an equal vote. Whether you were rich, poor, literate, illiterate, you had the same vote. So it was an incredible step at establishing an egalitarian society. The second is they enacted far-reaching land laws, land reforms. And those land reforms broke down landholding so that the old feudalisms began to crumble. And it's taken a long time. Everything they did in those 10 years, from 1947 to 1957, let's say, a 10-year period of the founding of India or the founding of the idea of India, all the legislations, all the paperwork, all the documentations were extraordinary. I mean, they all answered to the highest ideals of men. The Constitution of India was an extraordinary document. Everything they did to raise... You had a huge population of what they were then called untouchables, people who could not even walk the same streets as higher castes. I mean, all the legislation... In fact, it was made illegal to even call anybody untouchable. You could go to jail if you use the word untouchable. So there were all these things that took place that set in process all kinds of... set in motion all kinds of processes. Unlike almost all the other countries, post-colonial countries of the 20th century, the founding fathers did not choose an overnight revolution. They actually backed processes. And what we are seeing today, these million mutinies we are seeing today, I've come to believe slowly, are really the fruit of those processes. What has happened finally is that sense of entitlement that once belonged only to the elite of India, which only belonged to people of my class, has finally percolated down to everybody. So whether you're poor, you're deprived, you're nobody, you have a clear sense of entitlement, you understand you have a certain meaning and worth in your own country, that a certain part of the country belongs to you, and you're willing to today organize yourself, stand up and demand what's owed to you. This was never available to anybody except the elite in our country, people like you and me and our backgrounds. I think it's quite incredible. I think this is the true fruit of what the founding fathers set in motion 60 years ago. Wittingly or unwittingly today, what they have done is provided that sense of entitlement to everybody. It's still a long battle. I see this current phase of ferment lasting another 10 years at least, in which time, organically, things will, I believe, start kicking in. Because as long as we continue to back the vision of the founding fathers, for me, if there's anything talismanic about the India story, it's the founding vision of India. The founding vision of India rests on three pillars. I was at a conference just a year ago, my wife and I, in New Orleans, and it was a conference on rebooting America because America was in distress. It sounds quite quaint. And so at this particular conference, speaker after American speaker was talking about the American dream. And I remember I said that, you know, the American dream is really about the pursuit of wealth and happiness. But in India, we have the idea of India. The idea of India is not about the pursuit of wealth and happiness. The idea of India is very clearly about inclusion, compassion, and tolerance. Because fundamentally, we are an incredibly poor country. And we are also a very contested country today. And we have been a contested country always. We forget now because we are some distance away. But right from the 1920s, there are two ideas of India that have existed. One idea of India has been the one that Gandhi, Nehru, Ambedkar represented. The idea of inclusion, the idea of tolerance, the idea of compassion, the great three pillars on which I believe the idea of India stands. But there was always another contesting idea right from the 1920s, and that contesting idea basically was of a majoritarian Hindu nation. And we have seen that that idea continues to exist even today. So there is a sort of battle for the civilizational soul of India that goes on, and then there are these million smaller battles at every level that are going on. So the Indian experiment is an unbelievably complex story. It's a very, very complex story. There was, for a period, an overarching narrative. We can call it the master narrative. Briefly, there was a master narrative between, say, in the 40s, and the 50s, and maybe into the 60s. The master narrative fundamentally united all Indians, and they believed in one idea of India. But that master narrative shattered a long time ago. There are so many smaller, important narratives that have found organic voice and are trying to assert themselves for the last 25 years that it had begun to create a sense of panic in India. Today, if you talk to anybody, any elite from India, anybody, and you can try that out, you will hear a dirge. You will hear a kind of song of distress. Every elite Indian today complains. I meet them on a daily basis, whether they're rich or powerful or influential. They complain incessantly about how bad India is. But actually, if you step back and factor out yourself for a bit, you will see that really what is happening is really a fruit of the great egalitarian experiments that were set off 60 years ago. And in historical process, they're just playing themselves out.
I'm not sure I agree with the idea of a unified master narrative of India at the beginning, but we can come back to that. But yes, sir.
The question I had, Tarun, is much smaller than these big issues that you've just been discussing with us, and I'm embarrassed actually to go back to it now after hearing your discourse. But I was struck when you were talking about simply your story about the assassins, the five assassins, and hearing about your own assassination, I guess we should put it that way. strikes me as being actually a rather serious matter. And it brought to mind to me one of the most deeply troubling stories that I've heard from South Asia, say, in the last 10 years, the story of the Sri Lankan journalist who was assassinated. And before he was assassinated, he wrote, in effect, the story of his own assassination and printed it in his own newspaper. And I wonder if that story was in some way in your mind when you were creating this novel.
Well, actually, you know, that particular incident happened after, I had completed my book when it happened. It happened about 4 or 5 years ago, if I remember rightly. My book was done by then. I'd already finished writing my book. But, you know, there is, South Asia is a very, very fraught space in many ways. It's not just Lanka, it's Pakistan, Lanka, Bangladesh, even India. I mean, we also have the same kind of troubles. And I think largely what insulates people in South Asia is those who come from the elite and those who don't. I keep trying to say that. The problem is South Asia's own argument with itself doesn't factor that in most of the time. You know, there was a kind of elite created out of the colonial years and the feudal years, which has continued to hold sway to a large extent, you know, in most of these countries. And if you're actually out of that, I'll tell you when we broke our story and we came under a huge assault from government, at the end of the day, whenever I would travel to a smaller town to speak to journalists or to press clubs, you know, young journalists would stand up and say, but Tarunji, when we try and do these things, we find it's very difficult to do exposés or do hard investigative journalism. And I remember every time I used to tell them, I said, it's not your job to do it, boss. I don't want you to do it. It's the job of people like me to do it. Because at the end of the day, I come from the same elite embedded class that my prosecutors come from. It's very difficult it was very difficult for that government to finally run me down beyond a point. Because I came from the same class as the rest of them. I'd been to the same schools and colleges and universities. You know, it ended up being a class thing. I know for a fact that had it been somebody else who had done the same expose, the same kind of investigations that we had done, had they come from another kind of class, the system would have wiped them out. It was very difficult for the system to clean me out because I came from within the system. You know, and so that becomes one of the things in the whole challenge there. But to answer your question, very simply, in the writing of the book, I was really, really, you know, I live cheek by jowl with Sri Lanka. But if you ask me, do I understand Sri Lankan politics, I don't. I mean, I struggle just to understand India. It's the only country in the world I can begin to understand. And even that, when I was 19, I used to say, you know, I know what India's about. But at 49, I can't make any sense of it, you know. So I just struggle to make any sense of it because it's so contradictory. I mean, there's the old cliche that we always use. Everything you say about India, the opposite is also true, you know. So you can't make any easy summations with a subcontinent of that size. And as you grow older, you see more and more the scars of long history, the scars of short history, and how many organic movements are afoot today in that country. At any given point, if I stand up on a podium, I can count 25 movements. And that's because of the work that Tehelka does on a daily basis. Movements around the country against nuclear installations, against land grab, against mining rights, against the takeover of forests. So there are all these, and we are 1,200,000,000 and growing, you know. And so it's no answer to that becomes ever easy.
Yeah, please.
Taking the discussion back to literature, you said that you don't really read Indian literature in English anymore. So I would like to ask, do you read things in other languages? But also, when do you think was the great point in Indian literature? In the modern period, or was it something in the pre-modern age? And you talked about 1947 as a very important moment in the nation. Do you think that produced any good literature? And One more final thing. My favorite novel is all about Hatter, and I wanted to know how you feel about it.
Quickly, first of all, the last bit first. All about H. Hatter, I think I read it when I was 20 years old. I had to hunt it down. It didn't exist. It was out of print, actually. All about H. Hatter is a book that was written in the 1940s. It's a pastiche. It's written by a man called G.V. Desani. And in a curious way, he predates even the Salman Rushdie's magic realist experiment by almost 35, 40 years. And very few Indians have also read all about H. Hatter, because it's actually quite difficult to read, because it's just such a prestige. But, you know, when I look, and I was very taken up by Hatter, let me tell you, when I read it, I thought it was marvelous, and I loved it, and I used to proselytize all about H. Hatter to everybody. But, you know, I don't think I would be so kind to it now. I think if I were to look at it now, I'd struggle to find the real content in that book. I can see the form. And the form was, in a sense, the content, because it was a great play on the kind of, you know, the language clashes, you know, and the language usurpations of the time. But I'm not too sure it'll do it for me now. I have to go back to it. But coming back to what's been important, maybe we missed a step. I don't get to read as much other language literature because there are no good translations. It's another big challenge. We don't translate well enough because there's no money in the translation business in India. So people don't translate efficiently and well enough. Every time there is a good translation, I try and lay my hands on it. But offhand, I can think of at least half a dozen terrific books in the languages which probably have no match. I mean, you talk about 47 Sadathasan Manto's body of work is extraordinary. There has been nothing comparable since then, you know, in terms of literary value. We know Premchand's work between the 20s and the 40s was substantial. I mean, it was engaged. Tagore's work was substantial in many ways. So they were substantial writers. I mean, also in other languages. I mean, in Tamil, in Telugu, in Malayalam, in Kannada. I mean, there have been writers. It's not as... If you want to be a big recent book, which I think is extraordinary in its depiction of modern India, it's Raag Darbari, Shrilal Shukla's. I mean, that's available in a very good translation, by the way, which is what I read in. I think Gilly Wright's translated that. It's very, very good. So there have been books, you know, Vijayan's Kasakinte Itihasam, The Legends of Kasak. So there have been books which have rung true and solid and held up a mirror to, you know, who we are or played the role of the subvert that literature should do. In English, you struggle to actually find it, you know. You actually struggle to find books that kind of grab you by your throat, you know, and show you the country and who you are. You know, as a people, and that's really what I was complaining about. And I see that those books are waiting to be written. I don't know how many of you visit India, or those of you who ever visit India, have to just take a car ride 1 hour outside of Delhi in any direction, or Bombay in any direction, or just take a 1 hour car drive in Delhi or Bombay and keep your eyes open. Which, by the way, Indians don't. Indians don't see. Huh? We have an incredible ability not to see,
especially when we're driving.
No, we don't see. Fundamentally, we just don't see, even when we drive. You know, I mean, you come to my city, Delhi, which is the capital of India, you know, where a lot of India's urban money pours in. And on every traffic light, you will find children 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old knocking at your windows asking for a rupee. But most Indians don't even see that. They cannot see it. It's extraordinary. They don't see it. In fact, one of the best compliments I got for the story of my assassins was from a friend of mine who said, for the first time, after having read my book, when he got off at the New Delhi railway station, he saw the rag boys who live under the railway platforms. He said, till then, he'd never even looked at them. He said, for the first time, I looked at them and said, who are these guys? Why are they living under the platform? All these years, he said, I never looked at them. And that's uniquely Indian that we don't see. You know, I mean, we don't see. So.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm actually about halfway through your book. It's been sitting on my nightstand for a while. I'm about halfway through. The questions I had, and I'm enjoying it very much. The first one is that, you know, someone, I teach a course on contemporary South Asia here at BU, and I'm originally from Bangladesh. But one thing that often emerges in the class is in this question of what is India and how does India today see its, what is the narrative? One response that's often emerged organically from the class is that it's somehow to do with Bollywood. That, in effect, the whatever, which, and of course, films and movies have been around for a long time and very important in Indian culture, you know. But especially over, you know, the late 20th century and the early 21st century, that it has become the glue, the cultural glue in India. Not so much the fiction, the writing, but, you know, but it is, you know, it's the film. And second, very quickly, that as someone from Bangladesh, I find that in a place in Bangladesh where there is a very vigorous Bengali language, you know, a flowering of literature, poetry, stories, very, very vigorous, that part of the issue may have to do, which is the beauty and the problem of India, as you yourself put it, is the English, the use of English language. You know, whereas in Bangladesh you have this flowering in Bengali, which I think is in some ways, you know, much more reflective and reaches much more, you know, many more people in Bangladesh. Thank you.
Yeah, I'll take the second question first. You know, I mean, this is something I've been saying for years, ever since I wrote my first novel, The Alchemy of Desire. The problem with writing in English is that English fundamentally reflects the character and the tonalities of the people who invented the language. I mean, the virtues of the English language are understatement, irony, cool. You know, whereas the subcontinental reality is exactly the opposite. The Indian reality is melodramatic, noisy, sentimental, colorful, chaotic. I mean, all of which, by the way, are very difficult. So the challenge is, how do you carry a reality that's completely overblown in a language whose virtues are really understatement? I mean, when you write in the English language, you know, your virtues are irony and understatement. So it's a huge challenge to do that. As a creative writer, it's a massive challenge. And so you have to try and bend the rules. You're absolutely right, because the second part of your observation connects with your first. I myself often say that the true representative of Indian reality is actually Bollywood. Bollywood is overblown, noisy, irrational, chaotic, you know, sentimental. So it's true. But having said that, the job of literature is different from the job of cinema. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, the truth of Bollywood also is that Bollywood is unbelievably infantile. I mean, all the Bollywood directors are personal friends of mine. The actors are personal friends of mine. And you sit with them and have a drink personally, and they themselves actually lament the fact that the business is so infantile, and they can't seem to crack it. I mean, how do you kind of raise it to a more mature, you know, intelligent discourse? Writing, on the other hand, and the writing particularly of literature, I believe, is, in this day and age, maybe 50 or 100 years ago, part of the purpose of writing, of pursuing literature, was amusement, entertainment. Part of the job of literature was providing amusement, entertainment, and other things. But I believe today its only job is really to provide a great deal of discomfiture and questions. You know, I mean, if you want amusement and entertainment, you have television, you have cinema. I mean, it's breathless. We live in an age of amusement. The world is trying to amuse us all day. You know, so I don't think that's any more the role of literature, really, to amuse you or entertain you. It's really to discomfort you. At least that's the way I read my vocation, both as a journalist, by the way, and as a novelist. My job is to provide discomfort. You know, I want people who read me or follow my work to actually think about what's being said to them. And you know, at FNAC, somebody asked me that when my third novel just came out in French. I was at FNAC in Paris, and a woman rose from the audience and said, you know, I'm having real trouble with this book, and said, you know, it's really disturbing me, and I don't sleep well at nights. I said, that sounds perfect to me, you know. I mean, that's exactly what I want, you know. I don't want you to go home and sleep well at night, you know. You watch or read other things if you want to sleep well at night, yeah. So it's true. Bollywood is, in a many sense, it is the cultural glue, and in fact, a little scarily, it's the only cultural index in such a large country. It's actually been overriding even local vocabularies and local cinemas, and that people worry about that too. That kind of.
So you talked very eloquently about the dichotomy of India, right?
It's dichotomies.
Dichotomies. Yeah, endless, the million mutinies, endless. The dichotomies. And, you know, how things are so difficult, and there's great ferment. But then you also sound very hopeful, because when you're talking about the entitlement of people, the ordinary man, what is... So are you hopeful? Because, you know, where I come from, I mean, I grew up in India, but I've lived in America for a long time, and I love the country, and I travel all the time. And I want other people excited about India, but things are difficult. Things are terribly difficult. So, are you hopeful?
Well, I'm like what I said about India. Everything you say about India, the opposite is also true. So, right. In my case, also all the opposites are true.
Right.
That I'm both hopeful and pessimistic.
So, what
about
are
India.
You? What are you hopeful about?
I'll tell you what I'm hopeful about. I'm hopeful about the fact that some incredibly great men and women undertook a great experiment in human affairs, which is the idea of India. I mean, they took a subcontinent divided along dozens of dangerous fault lines and imagined they could weld it together into one melting pot or one patchwork and make it work, answering to high democratic ideals. And they made it work largely. I find that extraordinary. So every time I look at the India story, which is why I said earlier, We will flounder if we lose sight of the founding vision. That's the thing. If we hold on to the founding vision, we will fundamentally be okay, because a lot of the chaos and mess that you're seeing right now is arising out of the fact that it is the setting free of a billion people.
Can I just interject here for a second? So you've been mentioning this founding vision, right? But as far as I can tell, when you talk about the founding vision, what you're really talking about is democracy. Is there anything else in the founding vision besides democracy?
Democracy, egalitarianism. I mean, the idea of social of political and social affirmation. And much before it started in America, we had reservations for our worst off in the 1950s. I mean, you had segregation in America through the 60s. We had outlawed every kind of segregation or profiling, adverse profiling in 1950. Every single piece of legislation between 1947 and 1957 asserts and reasserts the equality of its people. I mean, and given the fact that you were coming out of a country that was fundamentally 6 or 7% elite and 92% poor and deprived, it's an unbelievable exercise.
So you're hopeful about the vision that was enacted in 1947. So
that is the only vision India can live by. It's the only vision.
So I'm going to, ask a follow-up question. So who do you think is going to lead this vision? Is it? Because it's clearly, not the leaders.
It doesn't have to be led. First, it has to be followed. We have to keep reminding ourselves that there is an original covenant, and the covenant is really a social contract. And part of the problem is the Indian elite today, which in the last 25 years has forgotten that the entire bedrock of the Indian story rests on the social contract. Every single founding father was born an elite individual. I mean, Nehru went to Harrow and Cambridge, Gandhi went to Lincoln's Bar. Even Ambedkar, who was born a Dalit, an untouchable, came to Columbia University on a scholarship. They all came from the elite, and they all kind of put that aside with a clear notion of the greater good. I'm saying it's just built into the India story that if you're part of the elite, you have a social contract. And I think in the last 20 or 30 years, it's that loss of that idea that we have a social contract that's actually creating a great deal of trouble, where a lot of people today seem to imagine. So you see this kind of tussle. I mean, let's look at something crude. Let's look at subsidies or social legislations. Every time a social legislation is enacted in India, the English-speaking press, which is largely the corporate press, backed by industrial and corporate houses, starts crying blue murder. The deficit is going to rise. The GDP is going to fall. I mean, there's a whole lot of noise. It again shows a kind of myopia to not understand that you have 600 million people living in that country who live at sub-Saharan poverty levels. We have more poor people in India than all of Africa, than the entire population of Africa. We don't want to see it. We get hysterical. There's an MNREGS which was enacted 4 years ago. It assures, let me tell you what it assures, because it's always being attacked in the English press. All it assures is that a family of four will be given, one of them will be given 100 days of work in a year at 120 rupees, $2.50 a day, 100 days of work for a family of four. What is that? I mean, you can't get more subsistence than that. In America, they bail out bankers worth billions who've crashed the global markets, and the state bails them out with billions. But we get lectured for bailing out the poorest of the poor. I don't understand. And the problem, I'll tell you, is what? And I say this in India, and I say it to the leaders who do this. The problem is we look over our shoulders. We look for approval to the West. We look for approval outside India. And I keep saying, stop looking for approval. We don't need certificates from anybody. Our problems are our own. Our issues are our own. We need to deal with them. They're unique unto us. Nowhere else in the world do you have 17% of the world's population living on 2% of the world's landmass. So it's a huge challenge, And the only way we can deal with it is by completely reading ourselves right. We don't have to read ourselves through anybody else's eyes. We have to see what our own problems are, and we've got to learn to deal with them. They're completely unique, our problems.
I came across your article, A Miracle Train of Myriad Millions, which is highly optimistic about the successes of Indian democracy, which I thought was refreshing, because you don't see that at all, even in the U.S. But I was wondering what you were talking about before, how India's writers are the ones responsible for showing India as true, or as their true identity. But what happens if... I mean, you said your book is, I haven't read it, but it is mostly pessimistic. what happens if there is good literature, however it's ultimately all pessimistic, and just cast a negative clout on India as a whole?
No, I mean, all I said was that I don't feel it's the job of literature to either provide pessimism or optimism. I think the job of literature is to do other things, you know. I think it's the job of, you know, political leaders and religious preachers to provide you optimism, you know, to tell you there will be fruit and honey for everyone, even if there won't be. I don't think it's the job of the writer. The job of the writer really is to arrive, as I said, as close to the bone of the truth as is possible. I mean, that's why you respect a writer in the modern world. That's his job. His job is really not to provide pessimism or optimism, you know. I mean, at least I don't see that as my job, either of the two. I mean, my job is to really try and, as I said, excavate something deep and true from the time I come in and the society I live in. That's what I struggle to do.
So I think in the last minute we have left, and this is going to be challenging, is if I could ask you to sum up and talk very briefly in a minute about India's biggest strength and biggest weakness as it rises. I know that's a huge challenge, but...
I suppose the biggest strength is that it's lasted 5,000 years and then hummed along.
Or even the last 50, but yeah.
You know, no, but the biggest strength, honestly, as we stand, I think, is the founding vision. I think it's the plinth. I think the founding vision is extraordinary. It's unique among the nations of the world. And if we hold true to it, we'll be okay. I think the biggest weakness is going to be the fact that it's a very, very divided country today. And its fault lines are very, very many. I mean, many of those fault lines were sutured in 1947 and 1950 to form the idea of India, but all of them are open today. So it's a real challenge to find a large narrative that will, you know, re-suture so many different fault lines and help us keep going. But definitely the what we have going for us is the founding vision, the Constitution of India, the founding documents and institutions. I mean, those are the big things that we have going for us, and that's what's let us be a fairly rollicking democracy for 62 years.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Asia and the literary journal AGNI. Our speaker was Indian journalist, publisher, and author Taran Tejpal. Our moderator was Assistant Professor of International Relations at Boston University, Manjari Chatterjee Miller. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.